Hello and welcome to this week's Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by James Norrington. How are you doing, James?
Very good.
Just you and me today?
Yes, intimate podcast. I know.
I mean, it's been a very fascinating week in the world of politics, which we're not going to talk about because we're not a political magazine, but I'm sure I don't have to remind any listener what's been going on in Parliament. And in fact, the cover feature this week is updating our Brexit-proof portfolio, which did extremely well since we put it together about 18 months ago. But we're not going to talk about that today. I think it's kind of self-explanatory that there are the kind of companies you can buy in the face of political risk, particularly currency risk, was something we focused on with that feature. A lot of the picks we put in that portfolio were big US dollar earners. They've done extremely well. However, I think there are bigger risks in the world than Brexit at the moment, and that's what we're going to talk about today, James. It's an extended discussion around a presentation you went to this week from some famously bearish people. But there's a lot to take from this presentation.
There's a huge amount, and actually probably can't remember all of it, to be honest. There's so much. So it was speaking...
It's a huge presentation.
It's huge.
In a very tiny, tiny little booklet, which
little
I really
booklet
like.
With some brilliant charts. So it was. I went to the SG Global Asset Strategy Conference. That's an annual affair held in Hotel in Mayfair.
And just for the reader's benefit, you've summarised the key takeouts from that presentation in the new spotlight this week on page 11. But there's a lot more to be said than what you've said in the magazine.
Well, it wasn't even the key takeout, I guess. I mean, the key thing, the SG, just to give some background, they're famously bearish. Albert Edwards, the economist there, to start with, we've got to say he has been wrong for the last 10 years because he's a perma-bear. But when he has been right, he gets it very right. And actually, the reason that I looked in the news spotlight this week is actually, you know, they're not alone. It's not just just Albert. It's actually the Fed is sending some pretty bearish signals about the US economy. And as we know, it's still true that when America sneezes, the world catches a cold.
So let's clarify what the Fed has actually been doing. We discussed this last week with Simon very briefly, but the general point is that the Fed had been essentially ending its programs of QE, raising rates, because everything was hunky-dory. And that seems to have kind of come to an end.
Well, obviously, the American economy, it was enjoying the sugar rush of the Trump tax cuts. But really, the US stock market, the S&P 500, was going gangbusters. And eventually, the Fed rate tightening cycle has started to cause jitters. And actually, that's sort of seen the return of volatility. And in recent weeks, after its final tightening in the last cycle in December, not the cycle, but its most recent raise of 25 basis points in December, the Fed has since recently been making much more dovish noises, trying to change the narrative a bit. I think it's possibly been spooked by how messy things have got. But interestingly, in the SG presentation, one of the things they looked at, which I've looked at in the spotlight here, is actually they've looked at sort of the companies with weak balance sheets and the effect that that tightening is having on those companies in the US. If you look below the real top corporate behemoths in the US, the small mid cap companies, you know, they're not in such a good place, and I think that the pace of rate tightening was beginning to bite them quite badly.
How does that affect those companies?
Well, in terms of, you know, they've it's the in terms of their balance sheet, the US, you know, they in the QE eras and when interest rates were extraordinarily low, people took on an incredible amount of leverage. Companies took on an incredible amount of leverage,
and that's true around the world.
That's true around the
world,
and
it's true of consumers as well around
yes,
the world.
Yes, but for US corporates, it was largely to fund buybacks,
which was incidentally the subject of Paul Jackson's piece last week, yeah, which is very interesting.
Yeah, and that obviously that helped flattered some of the multiples that that are looked at when CEOs are given their annual bonuses, which is what CEOs were doing, and they're actually very short-termist, and it's weakened these companies' balance sheets, taking on debt. Debt gets more expensive when it needs to be rolled over and reserviced at a higher rate. That increases the obligations, the fixed obligations a company has, and therefore that's less spare cash for shareholders.
I mean, it's quite interesting you say, you know, when they have to refinance. But is that starting to happen now then? Is that refinancing moment coming around for a lot of companies?
I'm not sure. I haven't actually looked at sort of data of companies and what they're doing on sort of the corporate bond.
But it would certainly affect the outlook.
But it would affect the outlook. and it actually starts to make some of those liabilities look a bit less manageable.
And also, it would then have a kind of, whilst buybacks have flattered earnings, a rising cost of debt would obviously have a detrimental effect.
Exactly. And you know, with without the effect of sort of the repatriation of cash with the tax cuts and things that have helped flatter some of the real big boys over the last year, then it's actually the picture for the US stock market as a whole looks less rosy. And the chart in the new spotlight this week, we've looked at sort of the long short strategy of going long on companies with strong balance sheets and short on companies with weak balance sheets in the US, and that strategy was really starting to do very well in America. And I think Andrew Lapthorne at SG raised the point that the Fed was trying to get to grips with the pressure that companies with weak balance sheets were under. Is that something that could sort of tip an economy into recession? And that's why it started to make more dovish noises. And you can see that strategy has actually dropped off in its success since some of the more dovish comments have come out from Jerome Powell.
Very, very sharply indeed,
yeah.
In fact. And actually, what the chart shows, it's a number of global indices, but there's a couple of US indices in there, one of which is the S&P 500, which is the larger companies, one of which is the Russell 2000, which is the smaller companies.
Mid-cap and smaller companies. And actually, those are the smaller companies, the companies probably you know, like the FTSE 250 here, more indicative of perhaps the real economy, real domestic economy, that, you know, not less global, that's quite stark.
Okay, so that's a sort of technical financial problem that companies are facing, but I guess there is a bigger problem that all companies, and in fact everyone, is facing wherever you are, and that is the dreaded R word, which is increasingly being referred to recently.
Yeah, I mean, it's recession. We are at a point in the cycle, and what's happened in the past, you know, with when we had super monetary policy, which has been used to inflate assets, and really now we're looking at there's still seen some very bad negative. If you look in Europe, the unemployment figures in France and in Italy have been very bad for a while. And I think now, as the world is embarking on monetary tightening, this could start the real world problems could start feeding into asset markets, and also asset markets potentially that's where they could actually lead into recession. And I think an interesting stat that was mentioned in the conference was actually three out of four of the last recessions have actually have sort of started with financial shocks.
Yeah, I mean it's mostly charts, this presentation, but there's a few cartoons in there, one of which is Bull, Bear and the Elephant in the Room, which is, as you say, the cycle. And, you know, there have been certain politicians over the years who've suggested that the days of the cycle were over, but that's obviously not the case.
Yeah, things such as CAOs, for example, are not very confident. That's a chart that's been referred to here. The US the CEO confidence index has sort of dropped off a cliff towards the end of 2018, following falls in US.
That's in the US.
And globally,
and the US is probably the strongest economy, the strongest major economy in the world right now, really.
Yeah, but interestingly, people talk about having been, President Trump's very fond of talking about jobs growth. One of the slides in the presentation was actually showing how jobs growth can spike just ahead of recessions, as it did ahead of 2008, as it did ahead of 2000, as it did ahead of 1991.
Did they explain why that was the case? Because, I mean, jobs growth is something that's often mentioned by politicians in this country, particularly in the context of Brexit, given that, you know, there were predictions of a horrible economic performance post the referendum, which never materialised, and politicians often cite the jobs growth performance of the UK since the referendum as something to look at positively, but perhaps not. And I can't even begin to comprehend why that might be the case. Overexuberance?
Well, possibly. I mean, it might be a case of companies taking on people at the very peak of the cycle, just as we all know that sort of getting sign off on positions within a company is a difficult, laborious process, and you have to jump through hoops. And perhaps it's the same with a lot of companies that you're hiring late on, and then just as you get your headcount through, then things drop off again.
Yeah, I mean, it would kind of imply that management are not very good at reading business cycles, but I never said that. It is quite interesting. I mean, there are a lot of charts in this presentation. What struck you most about, which chart did you really look at and think, wow, that's kind of... That's really food for thought. I mean, we've got lots of... Everything is covered here. Every negative indicator you could possibly imagine is in here.
Well, it's known as Woodstock for Bears, this, this conference. So it's... Well, actually, I find quite interesting, I think, just given what's going on with... we're talking with the Brexit debate now. Obviously, that's the B word. All the negative talk about the UK... But actually, I quite like the slide which showed the report card on how euro area countries have fared on various currency area metrics, which shows, and this was the striking statistic that really jumped out at me, in terms of that France, Italy and Spain, which together make up 40% of Eurozone GDP, actually secure a very low grade on performance in euro area metrics.
Performance in terms of an GDP aggregate growth,
this is a number of metrics. So they looked at a scorecard. They're looking at favourable financial conditions, ability to borrow, integration, pre-crisis their competitiveness versus pre-financial crisis, productivity growth, post-crisis competitiveness, inflation anchoring. Post-crisis labour costs, fiscal policy option, and pre-crisis labour costs. And on all of these measures, so since the Eurozone's on most of these, so France, Italy and Spain actually don't look so bad on financial conditions. Well, obviously, that's probably due to Eurozone QE.
Well, it's a central ECB policy.
Yeah. On all the others, which haven't been sort of artificially pumped up, they're doing very badly, and that's interesting. That's interesting to me that Germany scores number one, and these other three the big four in Europe have done very poorly.
Well, that could feed quite nicely into various Eurosceptic narratives. But
There you go. So we hear all these wonderful things, and it's interesting just to see the other side of the picture. Although I think Albert Edwards is definitely a bear on the euro. He didn't give any sort of opinion on how he felt about Europe.
It's interesting. The very next couple of pages are about China. And you know, for a perma bear to have a slide that says China's hard landing has long been predicted, I mean, it's kind of a little joke at their own expense, I guess. But China's economy is looking a bit troubled at the moment. We discussed this last week in respect of car sales specifically. But Germany is having some growth issues at the moment, and that must be related to China. China must be, if the cycle is the elephant in the room, then China must be, the mammoth.
Well, Chinese industrial profits are falling again. Now, China, that essentially, I think Phil wrote in his Alpha report last week that he sees the similarities with Western economies pre-crashes, with a debt bubble being inflated.
Demographics.
Demographics. And China is in, I guess I wonder if finally now the one-child policy is coming home to roost.
Absolutely. There was an interesting couple of slides. I mean, let's get back to the markets rather than the economics. Value is something that they discussed at length in this presentation. And I know value is something that you have been looking at in respect of a piece you've written for our FTSE 350 supplement, big feature that we do once a year, which comes out next week. So not this Friday, the Friday after. But value is something that a lot of people are taking much more interest in at the moment.
Well, yeah, essentially, the rising amount of dispersion in stock markets as monetary policy is scaled back, but support is scaled back, and in some cases withdrawn. We're looking now much more at fundamentals with companies. And actually, one of the interesting slides in the presentation was that actually, value can still fall. When even when growth doesn't work, you can still don't expect, you know, it's not a free ride. It's when the downturn comes, you're going to get hurt with value, but possibly less so than with high priced growth stocks. But you then get the upside with value after sort of you have to take your medicine first.
So they're not perfectly inversely.
It's not perfectly inversely. No, not at all. But the interesting thing is, so one of the things that they looked at was actually, and this is a strategy I think that SG have implemented with some of their indices. They've got something where they looked at the difference between picking value stocks with a higher correlation of bonds and picking value alone and growth stocks alone. And actually, value stocks and bonds, that combination was better, performed better in downturns than some of the highly valued and expensive growth stocks.
This is kind of something Phil has touched on this in his Alpha newsletter.
Yes, he's been looking at he's been rereading Ben Graham's Intelligent Investor. So I've just been reading his report upstairs.
Quite a simple formula there around kind of allocations toward equity bonds.
Yeah, that simple equity bond allocations. SG, they've got quant strategies that's headed up by Andrew Lapthorne. They've looked at an index of value and bonds of just value stocks. So value style and bonds and that has performed much better. So that's interesting.
So I guess there was a word on this slide that I'm looking at. I know you're struggling to get there because there was
so many slides. Yeah.
Can you get this thing online?
I've actually got a soft copy, but it's sort of to. It's available to us who went to the presentation. I'm not sure if it's available. It might be a MiFID compliance issue distributing this to retail investors. So
sorry, readers, listeners, we'll just have to tell you about it. There's a slide I'm looking at which is talking about drawdown. So I guess the idea of it's page 61,
which that gives you an idea of how mammoth presentation this was.
Value bonds is it's not about growth in this situation. It's about protection from what is known as drawdown. So
yes,
not drawdown in the pension sense, which we have been picked up on in terms of use of terminology before, but drawdown in your sort of peak to trough loss in a tough market.
So the maximum drawdown. So if you have a portfolio 10% value stocks, 90% bonds, then your average it's 13% has been your max drawdown in recessions. That was shown. Global value and global bonds 60-40% fall. So the balanced portfolio 60-40 equity bonds, which is sort of looked at in the Intelligent Investor by Ben Graham, your maximum drawdown is 36.4%.
And that's equity generally.
Factor tilt in old money.
Yeah.
Global value and just global value and global bonds, the max drawdown is 39.6. So it's the value and bonds is still slightly more dangerous, but the larger falls. But what's interesting is that you compare that with, if you look at your risk adjusted returns and the reward for that little bit of extra risk, your average annualized returns are 11.4% with the value bond strategy compared to 6.9% with the balanced. So although you'll suffer that little bit more pain, and to be honest, if you've lost 36.4%, then you know that's probably psychologically as painful as 39.6% really. But over time, your annualized rate of return over 11.4 versus 6.9, when you know, with the magic of compounding, is worth it.
No value. It's something Algie's been looking at. I know something that Phil's been looking at. What do they mean? What do SG define as value then? I mean, I know they've got some sort of valuation views on this.
Well, they've got some interesting indices on this. So they've actually got something called a quality income. It's called quality income, but it's actually sort of a value strategy in a way, because it's sort of dividend yield and good earning income, but with strong balance sheets, and that's a sort of smart beta index, and that has outperformed. So that's very interesting.
It's funny actually, just to go off on a little tangent. Phil Oakley's piece this week in the magazine is looking at valuation metrics. He's looking at the PE. And actually, the impact of debt on valuations and how it can be a factor which means that certain metrics, certain yardsticks become very misleading. Something might look cheap, but debt could actually change the whole perspective on that completely, which is Felix telling you how to sort of get around. That's interesting, that quality value is something that you should be looking for rather than just cheapness.
That's going back to the 350 article that I've written.
Let's talk about that.
I have screened sector by sector against companies in similar indices and tried to pick a fairly diverse selection of stocks based on not too many from one individual sector. So diverse, but more concentrated in the fact that I've only picked 13 stocks this year. And I've actually kept a bit in cash, which is cheating a bit. But
that is cheating. It's completely cheating.
It's totally cheating in an equity-related feature. But I actually, I want equity returns where I believe in them, and I'm not sort of picking in sectors that the UK market I don't think is very strong in, or all the good companies are very expensive. No retailers. Although I have got Games Workshop, which
is kind of a retailer.
It's
not really value though.
I have some value stocks and I have some quality stocks as well. So it's a mix of styles. And actually, I think there are some companies that are expensive, but I think look worth it. Maybe not talking value in the technical factor sense, but in terms of, what I'd be prepared to pay for something. And then there's some other companies in there, like Triple Eight Holdings, which, has some potential regulatory issues, but actually looks very strong. It looks very good, strong on financial metrics and is actually relatively cheap because of some of those other problems.
I mean, the FTSE 350, certainly the FTSE 250, but, the FTSE 350 outside of the bigger sort of multinational companies, as you say, it's very domestically focused or historically a very domestically focused index. Have you struggled to find companies that kind of meet your criteria in the FTSE 350? There's a lot of nervousness out there. There are a lot of companies who are weak. Stock screens, I mean, Algae's Great Expectations screen this week has struggled to find any candidates. I think there was one. And it came out with a fantastic trading update before we went to press. So that there's none now. Did you struggle in the same way?
Yes, I mean that's as I said. I found that the good companies were very expensive. So if you were to then look at them on a forward earnings, so fine. So you might pay that for a growth stock. But then if you look at sort of the price to earnings growth ratio, a lot of them were on sort of 2, 3, 4 times, and you want below one really for good value for growth. So I avoided some of those companies. So there are some good companies in sectors that I just I'm just not prepared to pay that price for them now, because I think that the market is going to face enough headwinds and anything over. But we've seen with going back to retailers, but companies like Next and Boohoo that are quite good companies, but have been very vulnerable to any sort of minor disappointment because they're so expensively priced. And if we do tip into a recession next year, and I think a lot of companies, growth companies on like sort of stretch valuations, are going to be vulnerable.
And you mentioned 888. I guess one of the big prizes for that sector, for the gambling industry, is not in the UK.
Well, the US, exactly.
Absolutely. So is a sort of non-UK buyer something that you've looked at?
I've looked at a few companies. So one of the ones I'm least keen on, but I kept it anyway, was BAE Systems. So an industrial stock with it serves into some international markets and defense.
It's not cheap.
Cheap. Yeah, it is cheap, but it's got a bit more debt than some of the other companies that I've looked at, but still not a huge amount. It's about sort of 26-27% of capitalization off the top of my head. So I'd be prepared for that. So some of these companies, I've also got Glaxo in there. So some of the bigger companies that are a bit more international than some of the UK focus, but it's been a consideration. But fundamentally, this is basically I use SharePad. I look at company metrics. I have a brief look over what the writers in the IC have said about a company. It's a starting point. I should stress that as well. The portfolio last year we actually underperformed. Which I guess, it was a concentrated portfolio, that's the risk.
What was in there last year?
The worst one was Playtech, which was absolutely nearly halved
Yeah, funny company that.
Yeah. So that was, but again, I mean, I tried to, you know, I've been very conscious about sort of balance sheet weakness and you know what you're paying for any growth that's priced in. So it's in some sense it's style agnostic, but it's not strictly a value portfolio. But I've tried to include some genuine value stocks and other stocks that have slightly defensive characteristics that I don't think you're paying too much for.
It's interesting. It's a bit of fun.
Yeah, it's fun.
What you can glean from.
I fully expect the readers to give me a good shellacking on the comment section on the website.
I'll give you a good shellacking as well. Yeah. that's absolutely fascinating. I think it's really. I mean, the SG presentation. I'm just flicking through it again. It's mind-boggling the amount of data they've got in here. I think it will keep us going for the next 6 months.
Yeah, it's a treasure trove, and it's really really what I think one of the highlights of the year.
Yeah, I mean, it also slightly terrifying.
Terrifying, but you know, it's it won't be that bad. I mean, to cheer myself up, it's in a couple of weeks' time, I've got the hopefully Dimpson, Marsh and Staunton presentation where they're authors of Triumph of the Optimist, where they look at the long run equity returns and equity premium.
I love that book. Book.
It started as a book, and now it's become an annual source book sponsored by Credit Suisse.
Credit Suisse, yeah. And, you know, I've always loved looking at that because I guess the one thing that tells you about investing is that if you stick with it and you don't panic at these terrible times, and yeah, you can kind of mess around, but, you know, as long as you don't kind of like head for the hills and, you know, stick everything in cash and buy a Brexit box and lock yourself in a cupboard, then you're going to do okay.
Well, that's another thing that Phil said in his Alpha report as well. It's you don't run completely for the hills into cash. And while I have cheated and I've put 12.5% in cash in my allocation for this portfolio, that's largely basically because I want to stay invested in equities. If I was doing this with my own money, which obviously we're not allowed to do, but if I was doing it with my own money, then I would want a bit of cash there just to protect against if there is a drawdown in equity markets. But actually I'd be happy to own some of these companies over a 2-3 year cycle, but over 12 months, you know, the possibility of getting beaten up once more is always there.
I think there's something else to say about cash, and it's not just that you're protecting against downside, but it's giving you the opportunity to take advantage of serious market weakness should it arise.
Yeah, and
you want some firepower.
Oh yeah, you've got something. You've got some yeah, exactly. You've got some powder left dry for to pick up. You know, say that a really good company, Spirax Serco suddenly becomes cheap. Then that's the time to jump in and buy that. A really top quality UK company that's probably just looks a bit too pricey, and you thought, oh, I'd love to have got in on that when it was cheaper.
Yeah, absolutely. Interestingly, in the personal finance section this week, Taha Lokhandwala has looked at how you play with your cash position, particularly when you're worried about volatile markets. And I think he concludes pretty much what we always conclude is that it's not actually that simple. I mean, no. Moving into cash is not that simple. There are many factors to consider. And it's something John Barron often says when he presents at our events is that, you know, if you have gone into cash and you miss the days where after a bear market where things start to swing back, you miss out on a lot of returns.
You miss out on a huge amount of returns, yeah. I think you've missed a lot of the upside in equity investing comes in the very early stages of bull markets. And people, if you're sort of a Johnny come lately, so that's why you stay invested. You always need to have enough income to cover your expenses and to meet little surprises that happen in life. But in general, you have as little cash as you can get away with doing that. And sometimes you get out of the overall markets or get into sort of shorter duration bond instruments when equities do look a bit ropey, but fundamentally you should stay invested, and that's kind of what the Credit Suisse yearbook shows.
Yeah, which is a sort of interesting conclusion for utter pessimists to take, that actually they too are optimists in the same sense as the Dimpson, Marsh and Staunton.
Yes, well, as I said, if you look at the SG presentation, then yeah, these strategies, these mixed strategies, they're precisely designed to keep you in the upside and protecting some of the downside. And in his one sales pitch that he allowed himself, Albert, he did have an amusing slide of a bloke who'd been doing some sort of industrial machine work, and a thing had chipped off and smashed into his goggles.
That sounds fun.
But the caption was, because he was wearing protection, he still has his right eye. And so that's kind of the principle here. Is you don't get out of markets, but you make sure you're protected.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, James. It's absolutely fascinating. We could have probably talked all day on this presentation. It's extraordinary. Anyway, I look forward to the FTSE 350 next week. It's a mammoth undertaking that we painfully get through every January when everyone's still sort of easing back into office life after Christmas. But I hope it's going to be worth it. Thank you, James. Just to talk you through what else we've got in the magazine. It's still quite quiet on the results front, but we've got some updates, most of them from the retail sector, as you would expect. Not all that great in the main. The odd bit of good news coming out of there. Games Workshop being one of them, who had some results this week, which look pretty good. Only a page results. That will start picking up as we head into February. All the usual comment tips. John Rosier has updated his portfolio this year. He too is optimistic. Which would seem sort of somewhat counterintuitive given what we endured at the end of last year. And of course, we've got the cover feature, Surviving Brexit. It's a portfolio that's done very well. Lots more uncertainty to come from Parliament, I expect, so possibly one to stick with. Thanks for listening. Surviving Brexit, a portfolio that protects against political turmoil. Head to the newsagent and pick that up if you can, or get online and subscribe. And we will be back again next week. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.